Do we have questions?
I guess no questions. So, oh, there's Lola. Come on, Lola. All right, so did we tell you that you're going to ask us the questions live? All right, you can do it. This is Lola. She and with a couple helpers have been sorting the questions into groups. And
first principle questions, I thought. It appears many UUs feel it's okay to hate people who hate. Is that okay? What if I don't believe in the worth and dignity of every person?
You want to take it? You had a good answer the first.
I think instead of framing, I just want to slightly reframe the is it okay piece. As MLK said, hatred is a big burden to carry. And so in these times, what we have to control and any time is ourselves and the ways that we, what we allow to become our spirit and our way of being in the world. And so it's not necessarily about okay or not okay. It's just the question of how do you want to live? And how will you keep living? And so in these days, actually, I find it helpful to remember that the inherent worth and dignity of every person actually has not that much to do with the person. It has a lot more to do with a sense of our shared humanity and an affirmation of life as one. So that you're not responsible for liking another person, you're not responsible for affirming anything that they do, but only to live in a commitment to that there's nothing that anyone can do that would take away that underlying sense of our shared humanity, no matter what. And that's not about them, it's actually about you and how what it's going to do for you and your life. And so it's a commitment to how do you want to live.
Next question. Will my dog be in heaven?
Yeah, that's a good
universalist
question.
Universalist.
Right, I mean, the universalist would say that if anyone is going to heaven, all of us are going to heaven. And so that probably includes all the animals, if any of the animals are going.
Aardvarks to zebras.
Aardvarks to zebras. I think that there is this beautiful question that this raises, which is kind of what is a Unitarian Universalist perspective on the afterlife, right? And this is one of those places that I like to speak about our appropriate agnosticism, that around some of these questions, we as a people do not claim an answer. We have an intentional agnostic orientation, which is that we say that we don't know or we can't know or we only know part of it. And so that is at least how I think our faith orients towards these sorts of questions. And yet, what I will say about pets in the afterlife and people in the afterlife is that many of us experience a presence from those who have died. And whether or not that is a certain neurological, you know, experience of memories being evoked, or whether that is a presence in a more supernatural space, many of us have experiences in which those who have died feel very present to us in this life. And there is something beautifully mysterious about that, that I feel like cannot be answered conclusively and invites us to think broadly when we have these sorts of questions.
Okay, this seems like a good follow-up to that. Can you speak about what you believe about pure consciousness?
Do you have thoughts on this?
Pure. Well, I became a Buddhist when I was like 12 or 13. And one of the concepts in Buddhism is like creating a right mind. And part of that is to not intoxicate one's consciousness as one tries to experience this world as it is. And so for me, that meant that I committed at 12 or 13 not to drink alcohol. Or do drugs, which was a great choice for me. And yet, I'm listening this last week, I feel like all I was hearing was Michael Pollan talking about mushrooms and LSD, and actually how it can break down these divisions of the parts of the brain that aren't usually connected and yet connect them in ways that can be really transformative for us. And so, I don't have much thoughts about pure consciousness, but What I will say is that, again, we don't understand consciousness in the first place. And we're all trying these different ways of getting access to what it means to experience this world and experience the fullness of this world, and that is both a religious and scientific and cultural pursuit that we seem to be constantly trying to understand.
Okay, why did you decide to become a UU minister?
Well, because I could do nothing else. I mean that quite seriously, that as one of my mentors says, if you can be something other than a minister, you should be something other than a minister. Because the calling is tested again and again throughout the course of a minister's life and vocation. And so there has to be a deep sense of conviction that it is exactly the thing you are supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. And it's, I think with that, like, also just from a really practical sense, I feel like, you know, I went to school undergrad with, I was going to be a math major. I ended up as a theater major. And, like, this is the only career I could imagine where those two things really deeply come together. So it just, like, uses all parts. And I also deeply believe in the local church. Already? The local church and the power of what we can do when we're as a committed people to make an impact in the world.
A short answer is God told me to do it, and we're out of time.
So I'll be back.
We're going to, what we're going to do now, this is just like, that was part one. All right, a few more. Oh, look, here she comes.
You're a very prolific question-asking group. How do I not feel guilty for not doing more when I already feel stretched, but there's so much more to be done?
How many of you feel that way? Mm-hmm. Look around. Yeah. I mean, right? I feel like that is one of the defining experiences of this time. I think what I keep coming back to is this definition of courageous love that we talk about, which at its most basic levels is when the love of self, the love of the world, and the love of other come together to conspire to the highest good. And I know when I'm feeling that place of resentment, or feeling like I'm not doing enough, it's because of one of two things. One, I am not doing enough, and I need to figure out a more true way for me to live out my values. That feeling can be a good pointer towards redoubling or focusing one's efforts into something that is both passionate for you, feeds you, and makes a difference. Or it could be that place in which that love of self, that place of I am a part of this world and deserve to be nurtured and deserve to have my needs and experiences met, is not being valued in my worldview or my experiences. And so I need to figure out a way to take care of that part of myself, because that is part of this circle of courageous love. We are not just actors of courageous love. We have to embody that in everything we do, and we are a part of that.
I would just add that the most common pitfalls of that feeling and experience is then feeling immobilized from doing anything.
Right.
And so the practice is to simply act and do something small. It's like, you know, just don't let it immobilize us. So. Yeah.
Okay, these are two that are sort of similar. How do you reconcile close relationships when you grow in different ways? And what to do if your partner is not liberal and will not come here?
I mean, you could pretend you were going somewhere else.
Okay. So, a couple things. First of all, I think that we need not think alike to love alike, as a Unitarian Francis David said. And that's true in the greater society, and it's true in our deepest relationships. What we think that means, though, often is we focus on the first part of that. We need not think alike, and we forget the love alike piece. And so in those relationships, it's when you have great diversity of how you're thinking, to focus in on, okay, what are the core values of how you're loving? And those can be, you can express that love in all sorts of different ways. But to try to come back to the conversations and the practices of valuing one another for that core values of how you love in similar ways and how you value love in similar ways. Now, with that said, I do not think that every person, any one person, can be everything for any other person. And so it's okay if we do not end up with our closest friends having all the things that we need from them or our partners. It's something that our society doesn't do enough on lifting up the ways that we can find in many different places a sense of connection, belonging, meaning, partnership. And so I'd encourage you to keep finding other partners even as you find a place of connection for those folks. Good? All right.
What's next for the Burma Shave signs?
Good question. So that's the reference to the signs out on Drake that have been missing for a little bit. We had some, so I would just acknowledge that we did not have any sick, we had a little bit of vandalism when they were in their first version. We love our, and then the version, the different kinds of neighbors, and the neighbors at the end. But a few moments of slight vandalism, but the most recent version we put out there of We Believe Women, hashtag Me Too, we had a serious incident of vandalism. I don't know, whatever. So so that meant that those went down, and then now we kind of are in the what are we going to do next, and we have some different ideas percolating, and we have been also feeling like between percolating and actually getting something out there, we're kind of in a little pause moment. So they're coming.
But if you have ideas,
come talk to us. We're open, and we're kind of looking for what the next spark of ideas are.
There were a lot about our current situation, but this sort of captures it. Is Unitarianism possible in a Trumpian world?
Yes.
It's like the most possible.
It's like
actually.
Really possible. I think there's a part of Unitarianism that needs to figure out its place, which is that we have this strand in Unitarian thought, which is that we reform ourselves and society through the use of reason, that there is one kind of universal set of logical propositions that we need to discern and develop and then conform ourselves and the world to. And I feel like that sense of truth and order and rightness, for lack of a better word, is harder to find its relevance in this time in which truth has become so malleable. And I think instead of, Gretchen has preached on this, instead of doubling down on this place of finding our salvation through truth, what we need to do is find our salvation through imagination, through building a vision based in our values, which are democratic, which are inclusive, which are collaborative, which is conspiring for this highest good, that we can do more together, and finding a way to share that vision with the world and invite people to partner with us in that space.
Amen.
Well, I don't know about this one, but are the two of you in competition to create and deliver the best sermon?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, there is a great joy that I think we both have of being in a space in which we get challenged by a colleague. I mean, being, you know, in a solo minister in a parish, you don't have someone else who's constantly, you know, there, constantly present, constantly bringing their joy and their truth into the space. And I feel like that is a creative space for us in which we're constantly figuring out how we best ourselves and bring our authentic space to it. Not to beat out the other person, but it like generates a drive in us to constantly get better.
I'll just speak for myself. I think it helps to hold both a sense of competition and also thinking the person you're competing with is awesome.
Right.
And so I have a deep respect for Sean's ministry, and I think that that competition wouldn't be healthy if that wasn't the core sense of
right. Who
we are together.
That's true. So. I mean, it's competitive because we both are advancing the same mission.
Mm-hmm.
which is different than a lot of competition that we have in our world, in which we're like inherently set against each other in this kind of zero-sum game. You know, Gretchen preaching an amazing sermon helps our church go further the same way for me. But she's going down.
That was a great answer. Here's an easy one. Are you a lark or an owl? A lark being a morning person and an owl being a night person.
Guesses in the audience? What do you think Gretchen is? Owl, hands up for owl. Hands up for lark. All right, me, lark, owl.
Well, they're kind of even on you.
Pretty even.
They're pretty close on me.
I'm more of a morning person.
Yeah, my favorite time of day is around 11 o'clock at night. So
we have this interesting phenomenon where I wake up to messages from Gretchen, and then I'll respond to them, and then I'll get a response in the evening. We have this kind of like cyclical thing going on where it's great.
Okay, how do I remain hopeful? The older I get, the more I dislike life.
Can I do this? Okay, so hopeful. I've been kind of sinking into, I don't know, you guys were at the service last week, 10 o'clock was the one that AJ and Susanna spoke at and talked about midlife. I've been sinking into midlife in the past few months and feeling what it means to have accumulated a sense of like moments of great hope and disappointment and feeling that accumulation. So I really appreciate the question. In that throughout my life, I feel like what I've needed to do is to reorient my understanding of what hope means so that trying to think of it not as progressive, not as there's going to be some final moment that like life turns out to be,
ta-da.
Right, everything we all hoped it would be, but rather to deepen into life in its fullness, and then I'm waking up to the things that were already true, and so to keep in the midst of that awake as a practice to joy and gratitude in a deeper sense, to know what that means in a deeper way, a more mature way, a fuller way, and to act with that, and to claim that as wisdom rather than as a kind of superficial hopefulness, a kind of pretend optimism, which I think actually Unitarian Universalism and progressives are where we're at risk for, is to have a sense of like, oh, well, if we just keep working harder, that things will get automatically better. You know, I think any of us who live in life and keep living and staying awake, we know that is not true, and that's a recipe for ultimately the despair you're kind of tinging at. So I think instead to try to stay opening and keep opening and with a heart that rather than, as Parker Palmer says, rather than shattering, to instead break open to the fullness of life.
This one is directed at you, Sean, but it could be for both. Growing up in Canada, you may have a fresh, different view of the recent election and developments in the USA. Do you see the US going in a new direction, or is this just a bump in the road?
I feel like that question has a lot to do with that previous question around hope. The music's starting. So one of the biggest differences in political culture, I think, between Canada and the U.S. is in Canada, there's this sense that if you wait long enough, it'll probably be your turn. And things will happen, but very slowly. I feel like what I've experienced in American political culture is that there's this sense that it's intractable and already set up to be at logger jams. And it's very hard to, I think, live in a system in which that's the perspective you bring, is that it's inherently intractable, we're at logger jams, and nothing can really come of it. Don't offer much hope in that sense. But what I do witness in the States is, I feel like a vigor and a determination to affect change through many different ways that takes a different shape than in Canada. And I appreciate its demands for justice in ways that we are maybe a little quieter.